May it please the Court, good morning. I'd like to start by talking to you about the constitutionality of Missouri's DWI statutory scheme. This scheme, which is comprised of Section 577.010, criminalizing driving while intoxicated, and 577.001, which defines intoxicated condition as being under the influence of alcohol, controlled substance, or drug, or any combination thereof, is unconstitutionally void for vagueness because it fails to give notice of the prohibited conduct to potential offenders, and it fails to provide explicit standards so as to prevent arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement by the state. In Missouri, there are essentially two statutes that cover drinking and driving. There's the BAC statute, which is straightforward, puts a number on it. If you have a blood alcohol content level of 0.08 by volume or greater, then you have committed the crime of driving with an elevated blood alcohol content. Then there's the DWI statute, 577.010, which does not put a number on it, and presumably a person can be convicted of a DWI if they have a BAC below 0.08. So in Missouri, a person could be convicted of DWI if they have a BAC of 0.06 or 0.04 or 0.01, in theory. So the question someone would need to ask themselves is, what does driving while intoxicated or what does driving under the influence mean? Now, I don't think it's disputed that the point of criminalizing drinking and driving is to prevent unsafe driving. So, in other words, we don't want people getting into their cars when they're not able to safely operate them. But that's not what the statute criminalizes. The statute just says it is unlawful to get into your car if you are intoxicated. It's my contention that that is not specific enough, that that does not provide enough guidance either to a person who has had a drink or to a police officer who's going to pull you over, or to a prosecutor when they're deciding whether to charge you, or to a jury when they're deciding whether or not you've committed a crime. I believe the fact that Missouri has the two statutes, the BAC and the DWI statute, is reflective of these concerns about unsafe driving. So the BAC is the presumptive limit. It's the statute that says no matter who you are, even if, say, you can drive safely with a 0.08, we're still going to make that unlawful because the majority of people with that blood alcohol content cannot drive safely, and we have to put a presumptive limit. But then the legislature thought about the other situations. So sometimes people refuse to take a breathalyzer, so you have cases where you don't have a number at all that you can work with to prosecute. Or, as we're talking about today, there may be cases where someone has under the legal limit or doesn't take the breathalyzer, but they are still unsafe to drive. But instead of clearly making criminal what they're trying to prevent, unsafe driving, the legislature simply said driving while intoxicated. Now, respondents suggest that everybody knows what that means. But in one of respondents' cited cases out of the Eastern District, State versus Edwards, as recently as last year, a jury sent a note out from the jury deliberation room saying, what is DUI? What is DWI? Are they both the same? Is it illegal to have a drink and then drive? I think that's indicative of the fact that probably weren't 12 unreasonable people back in that jury room who just happened to be the anomalies in Missouri. I contend that the leeway that the statute allows police officers, prosecutors, judges, and juries to decide whether a person has committed a crime can and does result in arbitrary and inconsistent results.
How would you deal with the combined cases where you have alcohol and drug use combined?
I think the argument stays the same. I think the point of
how do you measure it then?
How do you measure?
How would the legislature draft sufficient statutes to measure cases where there was a combined from either prescription medication or marijuana with alcohol use?
I see your question. So I'm not suggesting that the BAC statute is the only one that's valid. What I'm suggesting is in the DWI statute, which criminalizes either alcohol or drugs, that instead of just saying driving under the influence, it should say driving under the influence in such a way that impairs one's ability to safely operate a motor vehicle. So that would apply whether or not you're drunk, whether you've consumed alcohol, or whether you're on a prescription drug, or whether you're on an illicit substance of some kind. So I don't think you would have the problem of measurement if the standard is simply impairment of one's ability to safely operate a vehicle.
Your guy was outside the car.
Correct.
And what was the evidence about his state of intoxication?
So in the alcohol influence report, the police officer approached him, asked him what the problem was. He indicated that he did not have a driver's license, and the evidence was that his eyes were bloodshot and glassy, that his speech was slurred, that he failed the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, and that he swayed.
Now, isn't that evidence that he was, that when he was driving, which was just a couple minutes before, that he was driving in an intoxicated condition?
Well, I would say two things about that. One is whether or not he was in an intoxicated condition is the very question we're talking about, because my contention is intoxicated condition is not adequately defined right now under the statute. So if intoxicated condition were defined to mean one's ability to drive were impaired, I would say it's arguable that he evidenced some indication that his ability to drive was impaired. However, I would also say that there were indications on the alcohol influence report that his ability to drive were not impaired, in that his...
But isn't your real argument that at the lower levels of intoxication, the person might not be aware that they'd reached some threshold that was criminal? And here he exhibited so many signs of intoxication that that's simply not this case. Even if in some other case someone who had a drink and was arrested for this might have a better argument.
He exhibited some signs, but I also think that the AIR reflects that there are other factors that may have contributed to those symptoms. In other words, so his speech was slurred, but he was wearing false teeth. He's in his mid-60s. He's from rural Missouri. There are many reasons his speech may have been slurred.
Didn't he admit he'd hit six beers?
He did, but he did not put a time frame on that. He didn't indicate whether they were alcoholic or non-alcoholic beers. I mean, this was 2 o'clock in the morning. He could have been drinking since he got off work.
What's your response to the Raines case in which the term intoxicated condition was used in a jury instruction, and the court found that that was a term commonly understood by the average individual?
Well, I think there are two responses to Raines. One is the jury instruction is different than what's in the statute, that being able to instruct a jury adequately is different than being able to inform people of what the law is in the statute, because that's what we are presumed to have knowledge of. And second of all, the facts in Raines are so extreme. I mean, the defendant was covered in vomit when the police approached his car, and he offered them whiskey out of jugs. I mean, that was a case where the facts, they were so extreme that I don't think the defendant in that case would have had an argument similar to what I have.
But in a less extreme situation, which is your client, I mean, it seems to me that the officer has a problem, because is the officer going to say, well, you kind of look intoxicated to me, but go ahead and keep driving?
Right. Well, I think the answer to that is, if the statute were clear enough, if the statute specifically said impairment of ability to drive, then in a case like this one, the officer really could go either way. So the officer could arrest him.
Should the officer have let him get back in his car and then follow him to see how he's doing?
Well, in this case, the officer wasn't going to let him do that because he admitted to committing a crime driving while his license was revoked. However, what I think your point is, what would a reasonable officer do in this situation? I guess my counter to that would be, how does Mr. Schrader defend himself against a statute that just says driving while intoxicated if he can't point to signs that his ability to safely operate his vehicle were not impaired? Because that's not a defense under the statute right now.
Your vagueness challenge, is that in deciding whether that's valid, do we look at whether a reasonable person in his situation would have been confused as to whether the statute applied to him, or do we look at whether he personally was confused?
I think it has to be the former, because I think you're going to have cases. You don't want to have a defendant saying, well, if it's a subjective standard, then I had so many drinks, I had no idea whether I was, you know, one way or the other. So I think it has to be the former. I think it has to be from a reasonable person's standpoint, which I understand is tricky, because you don't want to say from a reasonable drunk person's standpoint, you know. So I think
there's a lot of people, I'm sure, that are drunk who are fairly decent drivers.
Right.
So you're going to give them a pass?
Well, no.
But I think the test, I mean, I was asking is not whether he reasonably at that moment when he was stopped, but would a reasonable person reading the statute realize they shouldn't be in the condition he was in at that
time? That's correct. That's what I'm saying.
I know your argument is probably one of first impression in this state.
Yes.
But the state has cited numerous cases from other states in which the same argument has been made, and it's been universally ruled by all the other states that the phrase intoxicated condition is something of common understanding. Are you saying people in other states are smarter than people in Missouri?
No, I'm not saying that, but I am suggesting to this court that we don't have to follow the rule in other states and that we can have a more reasonable application of the rule and we can make it clear, and there are plenty of states that have made it clear. So that's what I'm suggesting.
What's the significance of his refusal in looking at whether he's an appropriate person to raise a constitutional challenge? What's the significance of his refusal of the breathalyzer? Doesn't that create a reasonable inference that he, in fact, was intoxicated?
I don't think so. I really don't believe that a person's right to refuse a test should be held against them. I understand that it's kind of a common sense thing. If someone thinks that they shouldn't take the test, they're going to refuse to take the test. But I would be very hesitant about making a rule in which we apply weight to a person's,
Doesn't the statute itself suggest that the refusal can be used against them as evidence?
It does. However, the right to refuse is still there, and the consequences are not criminal, but they're in terms of the Department of Revenue. You would lose your license for a year. So I think the fact that the inference is there, in this case, it's still not indicative of whether or not the statute should be more specific in allowing Mr. Schrader to make understand exactly what is prohibited.
If he wanted the presumption of non-intoxication, he could take the test.
That's true.
Or he can suffer the consequences of the statute that it could be used against him. So that's a clear choice in the statutes, correct?
And he did say he had 6 beers, and while you may be able to argue, he didn't say when, he thought they were sufficiently close in time that it were relevant to mention. Why doesn't that support it, whether, a court might find he wasn't intoxicated, but certainly you could find from that evidence. Why would a reasonable person not think 6 beers within a close enough time that you thought to mention I've had 6 beers was sufficient to be in an intoxicated condition?
Well, whether a layperson knows how quickly alcohol is metabolized is one question. But another question is, what is his opportunity at trial to defend against the statute? I would say that argument remains the same, which is the specificity of the statute right now is such that he couldn't make any argument saying about impairment of his ability to drive, because that's not a defense, because DWI is not defined to include any of those factors. So I guess I would say that the ability to explain away those 6 beers, explain about, timing or metabolic rates or the alcohol content of the beer he was drinking, that was taken away from him by this statute in his ability to defend himself.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin by following up on an issue that several members of the court raised, which is whether Mr. Schrader's case is the proper case to bring a vagueness challenge. Because in this particular instance, there was so much evidence that he was in an intoxicated condition that he was in no way on perhaps the lowest end, where someone might be confused about whether they were close to the limit. And in addition to all the factors that the members of the court brought up during Ms. Tupper's argument, there were a few other facts that I'd just like to mention. First of all, the officer immediately noticed that Mr. Schrader's breath smelled of alcohol. If he had been drinking hours and hours before, it's less likely that that smell would have lasted. And furthermore, when Mr. Schrader took the one-leg stand test after he failed it 3 times before the count of one, he blurted out, "I couldn't even do this when I'm straight." And I think that's a pretty clear indication that he knew that he was in an intoxicated condition. And then, in addition, there was the point that he refused to take the test. Missouri statute says that that is evidence of an intoxicated condition, in addition to the DOR consequences. And there was plenty of evidence when we're going to an as-applied challenge, vagueness challenge, which is how this court always considers void for vagueness challenges. This isn't the case to bring this particular issue. In addition, even in any other case, the vast weight of authority, in fact, I haven't been able to find any contrary authority from any jurisdiction that has said that the terms under the influence of alcohol or in an intoxicated condition is something that a person of ordinary intelligence couldn't understand.
None of them quite define it the way Missouri does, though. It's somewhat circular.
You mean in the statutes?
Mm-hmm.
Some of the statutes use different language, and granted, a lot of the cases that I found are much older cases. And so this language has been used really throughout this past century. I think that the words that I tried to focus on in those cases do match the words in the Missouri statute. Some of them don't say under the influence of alcohol, and some of them don't say intoxicated condition. So I put cases that use either or.
What does under the influence mean as used in the Missouri statute?
Well, I believe the way that this court has interpreted it, and Missouri courts have interpreted it generally, is, I mean, really as synonymous with in an intoxicated condition. I'll agree that the statutory definition is not particularly helpful.
And what does an intoxicated condition mean?
An intoxicated condition has been recognized as so affected by an intoxicant, not just alcohol, but also drugs, that the ability to drive is in any manner impaired. And this court, 80 years ago, held that a person of ordinary intelligence, a juror of ordinary intelligence, would understand what that means without further definition.
Opposing counsel says under that definition, her client would be unable to raise as a defense that, in fact, even though he'd had beers, he was really used to drinking a lot, and that didn't affect him, and he was able to drive without a problem.
Right. Well, I think that it's not the case that a defendant wouldn't be able to use that as a defense. He would be able to point out all the ways in which perhaps that his driving was fine, or the way his balance was fine. He wouldn't even have to show that he'd been observed.
He could show the alcohol had not influenced him.
He could show that in any number of ways, including some of the ways that Ms. Tupper suggested. He could have pointed out that he was wearing false teeth. And, in fact, a lot of this evidence was presented to the trial judge in this case. The false teeth, the fact that he was wearing insoles in his shoes, the late hour, all of those factors are before the fact finder, and they are perfectly legitimate for the fact finder to consider in determining whether or not the driver is intoxicated. And I think that one of the issues with Mr. Schrader's point is that he blurs the line between a sufficiency of evidence challenge and a void for vagueness challenge. A lot of the arguments that he makes are really about whether a fact finder could find in any particular case, depending on the driver's metabolism or gender or weight, whether they're intoxicated. But that's not a question of whether the statute is understandable. It's just a question of sufficiency. There is one point that I would like to make about point two, unless there are any further questions about the void for vagueness challenge. And that is that in his reply brief, Mr. Schrader raised a new issue, which is a Miranda issue. I just have two things that I'd like to say about that. First of all, this was a new issue in the reply brief, and I didn't have a chance to respond to it. And for that reason, I think the court should disregard it. But if any member of the court is at all interested, I just wanted to point out that the Miranda argument that Mr. Schrader makes is specifically foreclosed by the United States Supreme Court's holding in Berkemer versus McCarty, which is a case that Mr. Schrader actually cites in his reply brief, but it's 468 U.S. 420. A roadside detention like the one in this case is more like a Terry stop than like a custodial interrogation, and therefore the Miranda warnings are not required. I just wanted to be sure I got that out there. But if there are no other questions, I will cede the rest of my time. Thank you very much.
I feel like we've beaten the first issue, so I'm glad we brought up the Miranda issue, and specifically Berkemer versus McCarty. This case is distinguishable from a routine traffic stop that the court was talking about in Berkemer for two reasons. First of all, this was not a case where there was just an initial encounter and then field sobriety tests were issued. Mr. Schrader admitted to the trooper that he did not have a valid driver's license, and that was followed immediately by the trooper placing him in the patrol car. No reasonable person would have felt free to leave after admitting he committed a crime and being placed in a patrol car. As soon as those two things happened, Mr. Schrader was rendered in custody for practical purposes, and the full panoply of protections that are required by Miranda would have attached to him at that point. Whether or not the standard of review is going to be different because this was raised for the first time in the reply brief is a separate question. I think that even if this court agrees that because it was raised for the first time in the respondent's brief that we don't get to raise it, I think you can still take it up on a plain error review.
Was the alcohol influence report prepared at the jail or at?
That's my understanding, but I don't.
Okay. So at that point in time, was he Mirandized prior
yes.
to the alcohol? So all of everything that's in the alcohol influence report comes in anyway, right?
Well,
when he was read the implied consent on the AIR at the station.
After all of the, so my contention is that the Fifth Amendment obligation to Mirandize him happened as soon as he was taken in custody, and
right.
that happened when he was placed in the patrol car.
Right, and then presumably there's this time period that goes by.
Yes.
And then he's re-Mirandized when the AIR is prepared, because in addition to the implied consent, he's read those rights at that point in time.
Yes, he's not re-Mirandized. He's Mirandized for the first time at the police station.
No, I understand
oh,
that.
Okay.
So at most, I mean, everything in the AIR comes in anyway, right?
No,
it would just be things before he was Mirandized that you're saying.
Yeah, that's my point.
That would all be excluded. So the field sobriety test, his statements, that would all be excluded.
Did you make this argument in your motion to suppress?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But as for, I guess what my point is if we're looking at sufficiency or whatever, everything contained in the AIR other than events that occurred beforehand would be admissible. Did he make statements after he was Mirandized at the station?
No, at that point he said he was going to stop talking. But no, I think that what I'm saying is that none of that comes in. You know, that would be all the fruits of that unlawful stop, including whether or not the police officer wrote it down in the AIR report, that still wouldn't come in because he was not sufficiently Mirandized at that point, you know, up until the point he was taken to the...
Yeah, what you're saying is he actually exercised his rights once he was advised of them.
Correct.
But the facts that were visible to the trooper could come in, things he observed.
No, because the police officer, nothing that happened at the time the police officer put him in the patrol car until the time he's Mirandized at the police station, none of that could come in.
Not the smelling of alcohol and the
that could come in because that occurred prior to the placing.
Okay.
And the performance of field sobriety test requires a Miranda warning?
No, they do not. However, if the person is in custody at the time and they have not been Mirandized, at the moment a person enters custody, they have to be Mirandized no matter whether they're going to be doing field sobriety tests or just an interview, anything that happens after they're in custody.
And he was, I'm sorry, if he was in custody because...
Because he admitted to committing a crime and he was placed in a patrol car. So the test of
whether... He was told he was under arrest?
He was not told he was under arrest, which is not required in order to be in custody. The test is whether a reasonable person would have felt free to leave. And in this case, I don't think any person would think, after I just told this police officer I don't have a valid driver's license, and he told me, okay, sir, why don't you get in my patrol car, he's going to think, all right, well, I can probably just leave right now. That's the argument. There are no other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Case is taken under submission.